righty.
Let's do it, shall we? It is the 27th day of August, 2019. And my mind has already checked out. I'm Derek Hunter. This is the Daily Daily Caller podcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Thanks for downloading. Thanks for spreading this thing like the plague that probably brought down society in The Walking Dead. Tell everybody, get them on there. I love getting the emails from you guys at Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. Got one, somebody from Holland wrote and said that they're enjoying the show, and they're telling their friends, and they've got their close circle of friends listening, but they're afraid to go outside of that because there are a lot of freaking lunatics out there. And there are. I told them that I've been over there. It's lovely, lovely country. I've been to Amsterdam twice, and I went there strictly for the culture and the art and to drink a lot of coffee, or at least hang out in coffee. I already told you I hate coffee, but I hung out in the coffee shops just because I wanted to see how the other half lives. I heard good things. I don't know what the big deal was. Anyway, that was a long time ago. I was in college, man. What do you want? Yes, there are pictures from those two trips that my ex-girlfriend possesses that will prevent me from ever running for office, ever, ever. Anyway, lots of stuff to get to today. You can email me at the aforementioned Derek at dailycaller.com if you would like to enter to win a signed copy of The Immoral Majority by Ben Howe. Probably going to give that away this week. Got a busy Thursday coming up. Going to have two interviews, one for this week and one for... I'm gonna jinx it, but I'm going to say anyway. James Hassan, whose new book is about how the social justice warriors are ruining the military, he is for this week. And then a returning champion, so one of my favorite guests, Sean Parnell. He's got a new novel coming out that's released next week. And... he is a lot of fun, and we're going to drink beer on that podcast, because when you're an Army Ranger, you don't just come into a podcast and sit around and shoot the breeze and talk about your novel. No, you get them sauced. I really enjoyed meeting Sean last time, and his book, they sent me it just happens that we have the same publisher, although he's on the big one, and I'm on the little side one for conservatives, and they sent me an advanced copy of the audiobook. That's what I listened to on the drive to the beach and back. And it's freaking awesome. My God. I it's going to be hard to talk about the book because I don't want to give too much away because I want you to read it. But we'll see how we can work that out with Sean. Maybe we'll get him liquored up and let him spill the beans. I just don't want to be the one that spills the beans. Anyway, that is coming up. Recording Thursday. So we'll have Hassan and Parnell. And then I've got Roger L. Simon already in the can. Might do that for Labor Day. Just great people with great books, great interviews, amazing life stories, and all that good stuff. So we're going to get into all of it. Now I'm going to knock on some wood. It's from IKEA. I assume it's wood. But I just hope it all works out. Anyway, we've got a lot of stuff to get. Joe Biden, the bottom is falling out for Joe Biden. I told you this was going to happen, but I didn't think that this was going to happen this early. Now, whether or not he can recover, this will be a test. The next 2 weeks will tell you whether or not Joe Biden stands a chance. If this poll is not an outlier poll, if this poll that I'll tell you about is not a fluke or a freak of nature or just plain wrong. God knows we've learned in the last couple of years that polling is not an exact science or even close to an exact science. But we'll get into that. We got a bunch of other stuff too. But first, I want to tell you, speaking of polling, my God, you could be coated on the inside with polling and all sorts of other garbage. That's why I want to tell you about our friends at Life Change Tea. It's a game changer. I've been drinking Life Change Tea for over 3 weeks now, and I can tell you I'm feeling a lot better. It is 2 o'clock in the morning, and I am full of energy, which isn't going to bode well for when I do try to go to sleep, but that's on me. That's my fault. It's a good thing. It feels amazing when you wake up in the morning and you feel great. How does it work? Well, Life Change Tea is a proprietary herbal formula. It's a gentle daily cleanse, as they say, designed to rid your body of harmful intruders, which is a really good euphemism. Let's face it, our food was different 60 years ago. It was minimally processed, free of pesticides, nourishing and healthy for your body. And today, not so much. Got a lot of garbage in it, GMOs, pesticides, herbicides, heavy processing. They've depleted the nutrition from our food. It's no wonder you feel so run down. Well, get that stuff out of you. It sticks around in your innards. Life Change Tea gets it out of you. Try it for yourself. Go to getthetea.com now. That's getthetea.com. You can't forget it because you're like, what was I supposed to do? Oh, yes, I was supposed to get the tea. And then you just added .com and you're there. I drink it every day. Life Change Tea is not available in stores, so save the gas. Don't go driving around store to try and find this. Go to getthetea.com. Enter the promo code Derek at checkout. That's my name. And you get free shipping for your troubles. Follow the instructions. Don't get creative. Don't think, well, I can take more. I'll just chug this whole thing. That's not how it works. The instructions are very explicit, and they're there for a reason. They're there to help you. That is Life Change Tea at getthetea.com. Now let's get into the bottom falling out. Poor, poor Joe Biden. Look, I don't want Joe Biden out of this race. I think he is probably the easiest beat for President Trump, to be perfectly honest with you. He's so out of it. Doddering, I think, is the word that you want. You know, if he were your grandfather, you would have to have a conversation with your, well, with your family. What are we going to do about grandpa? If he's your father, you're going to have a conversation with your siblings. What are we going to do about dad? We've got to do something here. But he's not. He's running. He's the Democratic front runner, or at least he was. And actually, in his own defense, Joe Biden came out over the weekend and said something kind of funny. I mean, he didn't mean it in that context of him losing his mind, but it's perfect. And you just know, you can feel as these words are coming out of his mouth, you can feel his staff, which was sitting, you know, off camera, as always. The staff is always just off camera. I was one of them in the past for Senator Burns, so I know. You just sit there and you wait and you go, don't say anything. You could feel the staff just kind of, the shoulders going up. It's like they just got the chills. They're just going, oh no, God, no, please don't say this, Joe. Please just don't say that. But he did say it anyway. Here's Joe Biden from a campaign event the other day.
Is we are so close to be able to do some incredible things for this country. Incredible things. I just spoke at Dartmouth on healthcare at the medical school, or not, I guess I wasn't actually on the campus, but the people from the medical school were at the, I want to be clear, I'm not going nuts. I'm not sure whether it was a medical school or where the hell I spoke, but it was on the campus. It was on the campus, and the dean of all of them.
The crowd's laughing. I don't know where the hell I spoke. It's something to do with Dartmouth. I don't know. That might have been somebody's last name there. Actually, it's kind of funny. This is Joe Biden actually with it. He caught himself. That's a good thing. That's a good thing for Uncle Joe. But what it really shows is it illustrates how much his gaffes and the reporting on his gaffes are getting in his own head, which is roomy and echoey, but it's going to cause problems for him in the future if he keeps bringing it up. The best thing to do, of course, is to not make them in the first place. Be prepared. Be ready to go. Know what you're talking about. Know where you are, as was evidenced yesterday when he said, what's not to love about? I love being in Vermont, while he was in New Hampshire. There's no reason. If you're campaigning in Vermont, you have no business running for president of the United States. You should not be campaigning in Vermont. Nothing against Vermont. I'm sure that the people there are lovely. It's one of the few states I don't think I've been to unless it was just driving through. But you don't want to go to Vermont because they don't vote for a long time. You got to go to New Hampshire because if you don't win Iowa and or New Hampshire, especially if you're the front runner for a very long time, people are going to start saying things like, you're not going to win. And then they will go and vote for somebody else. So it's good to know where you are. It's good to know where you speak. But saying that he spoke to students from Dartmouth or whatever, that'd be fine. What he said was fine. But then he goes on to point out that I might not have been the medical school. And that tells you that his staff is talking to him. His staff is saying, Joe, you gotta stop with this stuff. You can't say that 40 people were killed at Kent State, for example. You shouldn't have some sort of assassination porn conversation with yourself in front of a crowd about, could you imagine what would have happened if Barack Obama had been killed? It's not a good look. It's just not a good look, Joe. When you say all of these crazy things, like RFK and MLK were assassinated in the late 70s, it's not good. Those are moments, especially when you're trying to win over baby boomers, since there's a lot of them and they're more likely to vote than millennials. You don't really want to cite things that are that are talked about as defining moments in their lives. Everybody always says, well, you know exactly where you were. If you were alive when Kennedy was assassinated, you know exactly where you were when you heard the news. I imagine for the liberal hippie crowd, it was the same thing for the assassination of Robert Kennedy. And for the country, everybody remembers where they were when they heard about the assassination of Martin Luther King. So you don't want to screw those up, Joe. And that gets in his head. And so when he makes it wasn't even a mistake, really. It was confusion. It didn't matter where he spoke, if he was speaking to Dartmouth students, but he has to go in there. And then he throws in the line, I'm not going nuts. I'm not going nuts. Maybe you are, Joe. Maybe you are, because it's not been a good time for Joe Biden. He has all the name recognition in the world. He has out-fundraised just about everybody to this point. But I imagine his internals and his fundraising numbers are starting to dry up. They're starting to get a little, what used to be a flow is now not quite a trickle, but it's certainly, the knob is about halfway turned off. And that's money is the lifeblood of a campaign. You could have all the name recognition in the world. If you can't go out there and tell your voters they've got to go vote and you're in this fight and make people believe that you're ready to win and you're capable of winning, everybody knowing who you are won't do you any good. Jeb Bush, 2016, he had all the name recognition in the world, if only in his last name. And since there are like five guys left in the country named Jeb, it was pretty easy to remember Jeb Bush. With his brother and his father having been president, he had all the advantages, including the party infrastructure and the infrastructure in various states, the people that were loyal to his family going for him. What he didn't have was really any justification or rationale for his candidacy other than what else is he going to do? And in a way, that's what Joe Biden is. What else am I going to do? He's already written a book. He's already getting paid. He's made $15 million in the last 2 years. What else is he going to do? I don't blame the guy for wanting to run for president. I just think he should have probably thought it through and maybe talked it through with people who didn't necessarily stand to gain financially if he decided yes. He should have had a discussion with people who could tell him no, who were comfortable with telling him no. That's just me. He doesn't seem to have done that. He thought he could just kind of waltz into this. It would be a given. His association with Barack Obama and the warm and fuzzy feeling that so many Democrats still have for the Obama years was going to make this a tap-in putt. But I went golfing on Saturday with my buddy Adam to this little horrible cheap 9-hole golf course near the house. I had a couple of tap-in putts, and gravity and direction and grass and my ability disagreed with those. So the best of intentions don't necessarily end up getting you the results that you want. They just cause you to swear and hit your golf ball into the woods with a putter because you missed a stupid putt. So Joe Biden is up in his own head, which again is not a place to be. So the reason Joe Biden is up in his own head is not just the reporting on his gaffes. It's got to be his internal campaign polling. Now, I don't know if his internal campaign polling is as bad as the Monmouth University poll that came out yesterday. But if this isn't an outlier, if this isn't a mistake, if this just isn't a bad poll, it would be reflected on his in his campaign's internal polling as well. Now, what am I talking about? The new Monmouth University poll. They write it up. It's really a shocking development. If this starts to be discovered in other polls, it's almost over for Joe Biden. He can make it to the next debate. He can limp to the next debate. But if he doesn't kick major ass in the next debate, not just being awake and louder and finishing most of his sentences like he did in the second debate, but actually winning the debates, then he's probably done by the end of September. Monmouth University, they write, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, and former Vice President Joe Biden are currently bunched together in the National Democratic Presidential Preference Contest. Movement in the latest Monmouth University poll, positive for Warren and Sanders, negative for Biden. This is a shocking development. The poll results also suggest that liberal voters are starting to take a closer look at a wider range of candidates, while moderates are focusing on those with the highest name recognition. Another key finding that could contribute to the growing volatility in the race is confusion over Medicare for All. Most say support for this policy is an important factor in choosing a Democratic nominee, but voters actually prefer a public option over a single-payer plan. So what are these numbers that they're talking about? Volatile. Well, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are tied at 20%, which isn't really all that unheard of. The polls thus far had them, you know, in the 15 to 20% range, both of them at different times, so that they might be tied up at 20% isn't all that shocking. What's shocking is that's tied for first place. Second place is held alone by Joe Biden at 19%. 19%. That is a massive drop. In the last Monmouth University poll in June, Joe Biden was at 32%. That's down 13%. 13% drop since June, since the end of June, is massive. There have been two rounds of two debates since then. The people have gotten to look at Joe rather than just go, hey, I recognize that name. And this number, these numbers tell you, if they're true, that people don't like what they're seeing. They're not a fan of what they're seeing. The rest of the field is sort of also-rans. You got Kamala Harris at 8%, which is the same as she was in June. So she, for all the hype that she's gotten out of the first debate, it's nothing. It was a complete wash. Cory Booker's at 4%. Technically, that's a victory for him, although that could be explained in the margin of error of the poll, because he was at 2% back in June. Mayor Pete down at 4%. Remember when Pete was the second coming? Pete was the savior. Oh, my God. Pete was the flavor of the month. They put him on magazine covers. They did town hall meetings with him. He was everywhere. He was the new thing. My God, he's progressive. He's got a military background. He's young and energetic, and he's gay. And then they said, let's look at what he's done as mayor. And they go, oh, my God, he sucks. Crime is way up in South Bend. That's terrible. Moving on. Because in June, he was at 5%. So Pete lost 1%. Andrew Yang, I still like Andrew Yang. I still want to get Andrew Yang on the show. He's up, again, this is how you would spin it. He's up 50% in the polls. He went from 2% to 3%. You can take the boy out of the press secretary job, but you can't take the press secretary job out of the boy. Then it's Julian Castro at 2%. He was less than 1% in June. Beto's down at 2%. He was at 3% in June. He's way gone flavor of the month. And then finally, Marianne Williamson, Oprah's guru. She wants to give everybody a crystal and call it universal health care. She's at 2%. She was at 1% in June. The support for the remaining 13 candidates included in the preference poll registered only 1% or less. So you can see that things are not looking good for a great number of those people who are up on the stage. We got some Bill de Blasio news out of New York City and education that it's absolutely insane. And you can see why he should not be polling at 1%. We'll get to in a little bit. But right now, it is a three-person race. And one of those people pulled a hamstring in the first turn. Forget the second turn or the final turn. Joe Biden's campaign pulled a hammy in the first turn, maybe out of the starting blocks. It has been an absolute disaster this summer for Joe Biden. And what's telling is what makes this even worse. Joe Biden has kind of been a man who hasn't done a whole lot. He hasn't really gone to many events. All these other candidates, you see them every day out there hammering. There's always a clip of them on the news or circulating on social media. Conservatives saying they so-and-so said something. Look what Elizabeth Warren said today. Or here's Bernie Sanders saying something crazy. And liberals are saying, oh my God, can you believe they're so brilliant and so excellent. Look at what they said today. Joe Biden's been off the campaign trail more days than he's been on the campaign trail, which, considering the number of gaffes that he has made in his time, his limited time over these last couple of months on the campaign trail, it doesn't bode well for his campaign. If somebody is out there really inspiring voters, if there's something about them that draws people to them, the last thing you want to do ever is get that person out of the spotlight, get that person away from people. Think about Mayor Pete. When Mayor Pete was the flavor of the month, back when he was up around 15 to 20% in the polls, he was everywhere. He was raking in the money. I think he led the last quarter in campaign donations. Maybe he was behind Biden, but he got like $25 million. The money pours in, the support pours in, the people want to see what is this buzz about. Let's go out and check out this candidate. Let's go and see what this is all about. You got to milk that time. And, you know, Buttigieg did milk that time. Unfortunately, other things happened, like people started looking at his record as mayor of South Bend and all the problems in South Bend, and they said, yeah, probably not, and walked away. Joe Biden, when he had all the goodwill of the name recognition and the cachet of being a former vice president, not only a former vice president, but Barack Obama's former vice president, he played hermit. He hid. He withdrew. He became Howard Hughes. Like, what in the hell are you doing? I couldn't figure out what he was trying to accomplish from a campaign standpoint. Turns out that they were just playing it safe. They thought that they could coast all the way to the primaries. Maybe they can. Look, I don't have a crystal ball. If I did, I would be a multiple mega ball, power ball, mega millions winner. I would just, every time, just clean up on those things. But this is not how you run a presidential campaign. And the reason they're running it this way, I think, has to be they're afraid that for the limited times that they've put him out there and all the screw-ups that he's made, if they put him out there as much as they would like to, it would only be worse. It would only get worse. it would be embarrassing and he wouldn't limp into Iowa. So you remember, well, you probably don't remember, back in 1988, Joe Biden ran for president for the first time. He actually dropped out of the race in 1987, never actually made it to Iowa. In 2008, when he made his second run for president, he did make it to Iowa. I think he was last or down near the bottom. It didn't matter. He didn't make it to New Hampshire. He dropped out almost immediately. So he's never been a good presidential campaigner. So to see this stumble this early, how they plan on bringing this back, righting this ship, pulling up from this nosedive is everything. You can have the best campaign staff ever assembled, but you can't polish a turd. It just smears. It really does come down to the candidate. If he can't generate excitement, if he can't get people inspired, here's what I think he should do. Because I think he should have done this a long time ago. I said this a couple months ago, but I'm going to say it again. If you're listening, Joe Biden, you can make the check out to me. It's all good. oh, that reminds me. Thanks you to everybody who donated to Kivi. To help take care of this cat that you hear screaming in the background occasionally and attacking other cats. They're playing mostly, but he plays a little rough. The GoFundMe thing that you guys clicked on and donated, it's incredibly generous and it means the world to me. Somebody emailed and goes, you know, people think you work in the media, you're rich or something. Like, I ain't rich. I ain't going hungry. I ain't, you know, starving to death. And I make sure that the kids are taken care of and that everybody's fed and we got a roof over our head. But I had like $600 in unexpected vet bills in the last couple of days. So the one with asthma needed to get a new vet and a new prescription, and the new one running around screaming. So the fact that so many of you stepped up and just chipped in, it means the world to me. I have to figure out tomorrow how to turn off the GoFundMe thing. But if you want to see pictures of the kitten, they're up there. I think I posted 3 of them. But I don't know how GoFundMe works. If I don't know how long it was supposed to go. I don't know anything about it. I just did it because I thought I'd ask. And you guys answered. And thank you for that. What Joe Biden should do. See, I didn't completely forget where I was. Although it is a little embarrassing to ask, but still, thank you. He should have his sister soldier moment. There is a lane out there in the Democratic primary field for a moderate Democrat. Now, the people who are arguing this case are the people you never heard of and you're never going to hear from again. John Delaney, the governor of Montana, who like Bullock, I think his name is. President Bullock. Sounds like it's out of a bad pulp fiction novel or something. But they're arguing you can't be full crazy. John Hickenlooper was out there going, you can't be full crazy. And he's dropped out of the race. Hickenlooper. Can't talk about name recognition. My God, Hickenlooper, once you hear that, you never forget it. But Joe Biden could win in that lane. He could go out there and say, look, we're not a socialist country. We're never going to be a socialist country. We should never be a socialist country. Socialism doesn't work. He wants to, you know, and then he'll have to spin his own policies his own way as to why they're not socialist, which they're not, by and large. They're just giant steps in that direction. But he could stand up to the campus crazies, the people calling everybody a racist and a freaking Nazi every 5 minutes. Joe Biden could stand up there and say, look, we can disagree on policy, but the president of the United States, Hitler, is insane. It is wrong. He is not Hitler, and we need to knock it off. We need to return some civility to politics. While the vocal base and the MSNBCs and the CNNs would hate it, I believe that there are enough Democratic voters left in the party that could benefit Joe Biden. Because Lord knows him trying to play Grandpa Wokeoff is not working. He doesn't have the chops for it. I don't think he understands the concept. I don't think he knows what's going on. I don't think he realizes all of his gaffes talking about civility in the Senate when he was working with segregationists. I don't think he understands the world that finds that offensive, which most people understood what he was talking about, but then most people aren't going to vote in a Democratic primary, so that hurt him, things like that. I think he could still have that moment, but I don't know that Joe Biden actually believes in anything other than that Joe Biden wants to be president of the United States, so he can't really stand up for something or to something if he's just willing to do whatever it takes to be president because he wants to be president. Now, his problems run deeper, and when MSNBC says what you're about to hear them say, it's an indication of just how deep those problems run. Steve Kornacki, who is, he used to host that show, one of the hosts of the show, The Cycle. God, that was a terrible show on MSNBC. I think he's the only one who came out of that with still having a job at MSNBC. And he's Brian Darling knows the guys. Good. I think he does. I think it's the one he knows. A friend of, you know, their friend says he's a good guy. He's a smart guy. I don't agree with him on policy a lot, but his analysis at least seems to be coming from what he truly believes. And that's all I ask. I don't care what you believe. Well, that's not entirely true. If you're a complete a-hole, I care what you believe. But if you're a racist piece of crap or something like that. But he did a breakdown of the Monmouth University poll numbers, and he found some really interesting tidbits of information, in particular, how Joe Biden is cratering with voters under 50 years of age. Listen to this clip. Steve Kornacki breaks down the polling numbers that I just told you.
Now, obviously, the question it raises, what will other polls show? Will they replicate what we're seeing here in Monmouth? Will this prove to be an outlier? That's a question going forward. But when you look inside these numbers, you see some reasons why Biden's in particular trouble here. Number one, it's ideological among liberal voters. Warren, not surprisingly, in first. Sanders right behind her in second. When you look at moderate conservative voters, this has been sort of a strong base of support ideologically for Biden. He still leads. But he's running at this poll at least only 22% among self-described moderates and conservatives. And then there is this. We have been talking all year about an age divide on the Democratic side, over 50 years old, under 50 years old. Well, check this out in the Monmouth poll. Democrats over 50. This is what we're used to seeing. Biden's in first place, double-digit advantage, solid lead there for Biden, 30. Now look at this. Under 50 years old in this poll on the Democratic side, not only is Joe Biden not in first place, he is all the way back at 6%. He is tied with Andrew Yang in this poll among Democrats under 50 years old at just 6%. So for Biden, look, ideologically, not getting what he normally gets from moderates, from conservatives in this poll. And age-wise, we're used to seeing him not do too well among folks under 50. But the floor pretty much falling out for him, at least again, in this poll.
6% of Democrats under the age of 50. 50 is not that old. So Joe Biden's appeal is really not good amongst people who are the energy of the Democratic Party. Whether or not they'll show up to vote on primaries or go to Iowa and spend all day caucusing remains to be seen. But that is a devastating number. Huge, huge problem for Joe Biden. Name recognition only goes so far, buddy. So you've got this collapse, as Kornacki put it, the floor falling out from underneath him. Again, we're going to need to see this number replicated, or at least this trend replicated, in a couple of more polls. If Joe Biden is at 30% in all the other polls, then this poll is a screw-up, and they should probably just scrap it. But if the latest Gallup poll comes out, or whatever other polls there are out there, names don't really matter, but if they come out and they say, yeah, Joe Biden's at, you know, 22%, or he's on the downslope, you can start getting the forks ready to be stuck in his ass, because it's almost over for him. Because I don't think he knows, he doesn't know how to campaign in the first place. He's not been proven to be a fighter. He has not been proven to be the comeback kid. Now, I will give this note of caution. It's very, very early. And if you look back at 2008 and John McCain, and I know you say that name and you cringe a little bit, but 2008, John McCain was at 1% around this time. He was a forgotten person. He was a joke. He was the candidate who was seen traveling in the airport by himself, flying commercial, flying coach to campaign events. And people would see him walking through the airport. Reporters would say, hey, what are you doing here? He was running for president then, but his campaign funds had dried up. His chances had been written off. It was over. It was done. It was out. I can't even remember who the front runner was at this point. It might have been, no, it wasn't Rudy because he wasn't running then. I can't remember who it was, but it wasn't John McCain. And then John McCain ended up coming through in the end and winning the nomination and losing, running a horrible campaign and losing. But just because you're out now, you're down now, doesn't mean you can't come back. Now, I'm not doing this as a pep talk to people like Beto O'Rourke, who hasn't really won anything. So he can't really, he doesn't have the name recognition. He doesn't have the skills. People have looked at him and said, no, it's not like they forgot about him. So people like that down at the very bottom, I'm not talking about them, but someone like Joe Biden could come back if he ran a smart campaign. That's the catch. When you've got a candidate like Joe Biden, it's kind of hard to run a smart campaign. But he's not nuts. Just remember that.
I'm not going nuts.
On the other end of the spectrum, you've got Elizabeth Warren. She's on the ascension for now. She never really had a honeymoon in the camp. If you remember her campaign kickoff, it's kind of her time to be the flavor of the month, I think. Her campaign kickoff was disastrous. She didn't get that giant bump that other candidates did. She didn't get that glowing coverage. Why? Because she shot her campaign in the foot the second they stepped out the door with that stupid video that apparently they've wiped off of their website because they don't want people to remember it. Remember when she did the DNA test? And that's when she found out she was like 1,024th some kind of possible Native American. She's like, I'm vindicated. I told you I have high cheekbones. I don't know what else to tell you. And it became a national joke, so much so that even liberals had to make jokes about it. Like 1,026th? Kidding me? That amount of DNA could have already been on the cotton swab before you stuck it in your mouth. Like, what are you talking about? But she's since been apologizing nonstop about that. But she's now in a good place, temporarily at least, in the campaign, tied up with Bernie. She's out there progressive. She's got a plan for everything. She's got a plan to organize her plans. She's got binders full of plans, you might say. Well, there's one area that she's not doing particularly well in, and that is with black voters. And this was a topic of discussion on CNN because, why? Because they're obsessed with race. It's 5 months before anybody votes, but hey, let's talk about race. I don't know who the anchor is here on CNN. It doesn't matter. They're plug and play. They're like Lego pieces. They're all the same. The other person is Jamil Smith, who is the senior writer for Rolling Stone magazine. How embarrassing. How bad are the bookings at CNN when they're like, we need to have a serious discussion about politics. Get me the senior writer at Rolling Stone magazine, shall you? Oh, yeah, let's do that. Jamil Smith, let's get him on there. What they really said is we want to talk about black vote in the Democratic primary and why Elizabeth Warren isn't getting any. So get me a black person. You see this across cable news. Whenever it's anything that has just a hint of race, suddenly the cable networks become roots. Like, what the hell? I find it incredibly condescending. Hilarious at the same time, because the white anchors are always afraid to say anything, so they just bring on, here's a black conservative and a black liberal. You guys talk it out, and I'll sit over here and feel guilty about things my ancestors probably had nothing to do with. So cable news is so awful. But white lady was talking to the black guy about the lack of support for Elizabeth Warren in the black community, which makes, I mean, who's Elizabeth Warren is not Native American. She's, as I say, she is so white that her camouflage in a snowstorm is nudity, and she completely disappears. But what was interesting is Jamil Smith, who's, of course, a liberal in good standing. I think he used to write for Slate or Salon or some of those, one of those awful liberal websites. What he says here about how Elizabeth Warren can go about getting black support in the Democratic primary, it basically says she's not going to get any unless she's the nominee, because black people will vote for whoever the nominee is. If you happen to, I find this is telling about how for granted the Democratic Party takes the black vote. We'll talk about that after this. Let's listen to that clip.
That's probably the best way to put it.
Playing his game, the way he plays the game.
Exactly.
There is the reality, though. Recent polls show that she still has just single-digit support among black voters, which we know is a key Democratic voting bloc. How big of a hurdle is that for her, and what do you think she needs to do about that?
Well, I think that that is something that she's going to, you know, certainly have to work on a little bit more conservatively. I think she's going to definitely that black support is going to consolidate around whoever becomes the nominee. I think that, you know, we need to be realistic about that. The black support is not going to consolidate. The black folks are not going to simply, come down to the Democratic nominee and Donald Trump and say, I think we have a choice to make here. They're going to consolidate around the Democratic nominee.
Hear that, black people? It doesn't matter. They're going to vote for Democrats anyway. So nobody really has to try and make it. She should try to reach out and maybe make an appeal to try and get some votes in the primary. But she doesn't really have to. If she wins the nomination on the backs of white people and her fellow Native American tribesmen, then the black vote will get in line, because the black vote always gets in line. We take it for granted because we can. Because, I mean, ask the people of Baltimore how well that's worked out. Ask the people of Washington, D.C. Ask the people of Chicago, Detroit, St. Louis, you name the city. Ask them how well that's worked out for them. And get back to me on that, won't you? But this is the mindset of the Democratic Party. We own the black vote. It doesn't matter. They might not like Elizabeth Warren, but don't worry. When it comes voting time, they'll go into the polling place and do what they're told. They'll hunt for the D after the person's name and punch that hole. How condescending is that? How awful is that? And again, how destructive has that been? It's true. He's saying it because it's true. They're just not usually, these pundit types are not usually this blatant about it. They don't usually come right out and say it. Look, it doesn't matter. Ultimately, whoever the Democrats nominate, the black vote will be there. It's all good. Don't sweat it. Don't worry about it. Everybody knows their role. Everybody knows their place. Yeah, the 9% who will vote for Republican, they don't really count. They're not really black anyway, so we can just forget about that. You don't even have to pretend to care, which makes everybody look foolish, because they all went up and kissed the ring of Al Sharpton and promised that they were going to be for reparations. Remember that? Oh, yes, absolutely. We've got to pay that debt. Reparations. Why? Now they're just coming out and saying it. Don't worry about it. The black vote will be there for you. Stop stressing. It's all good. It's incredibly condescending and, dare I say, racist. But it's also progressive. So what are you going to do? While we're on the subject of Democrats running for president, there's a quick little note about Beto. He's still out there. He still thinks that he can win the nomination. Oh, you almost feel sorry for him if he weren't such an insufferable ass. Beto O'Rourke is speaking to a group, and he went off about immigration, of course. His favorite new word is, every sentence involves the word racism. You're racist. This is racist. The country's fundamentally racist. Founded on racism. Can't get rid of the racism. Racist. And then he starts talking about what's going on with immigration and the crush of illegal aliens storming across our southern border. He, of course, finds a way to blame the United States of America. Why? Because he doesn't seem to like this country very much. The guy was born on third base, acts like he hit a triple, and married the daughter of a billionaire. A billionaire. He was already born into a fortune, I'm assuming, because his parents were friends with his wife's parents, and billionaires don't tend to hang out with, you know, checkout people at Kmart. You know, my family never rolled with billionaires. There was one guy. I remember one guy. The story was he was a millionaire. He did something with the auto industry, but I'm not going to say his name. But I just remember hearing that he bought his kids a case of baseball cards every year. I would buy, you know, I'd scrounge up and have to trade in to buy a box of baseball cards and try and make a set that way. And this family, every year they got a case of baseball cards, which is 12 boxes. It was unheard of. Only dealers had that kind of money. But that was the close. It was a millionaire. Whatever, probably just a million. He probably wasn't a millionaire, but I don't know. But that was the story, because they were the rich kids at the ice rink. Their kids played hockey with, one of them played with me. And so billionaires don't tend to roll with average people. They just don't. It'd be nice if they did, but they don't. So the idea that Beto was, you know, bootstrapped his way up, not so much. He's born wealthy and then married wealthier, which is a good business model, if nothing else. But Beto goes on about how the United States, the evil, racist United States of America, is responsible for all the ills in South and Central America.
With the people of Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador reduce violence in their home communities, violence which we are somewhat to blame for, the civil wars that we've been involved in, the drug trade that we facilitated, the war on drugs that has militarized and hollowed out their civic institutions in their home countries, and Guatemala suffering one of the greatest droughts in their recorded history, caused not by God nor by Mother Nature, but by you and me and all of us in our omissions and our excesses and our inaction in the face of the facts and the science and the truth.
First off, how in the hell did we hollow out their civic institutions by the war on drugs? How did we militarize them? And by the way, all those wars that we got involved in, we were aiding people who were trying to be free of communism. I realize, Beto, that that's, you know, a no-no now in Democratic circles. But there was a time in this country when even Democrats thought that people should not be oppressed by their government. There's also this little thing called the Monroe Doctrine that, while, you know, they sort of exempted Cuba, basically said to the rest of the world, this hemisphere is to be left alone by you people. And it functioned pretty well in this hemisphere. People, for the most part, were free. There were some exceptions, free-ish. See, we make a mistake in this country, commonly. And we did this, and this is, I think, is the biggest flaw in our Middle East policy. We'll get back to Beto's stupidity in a second. This is a flaw in our Middle East policy. In Afghanistan, we should have absolutely gone in there and blown the living crap out of every member of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda we could find. And we shouldn't have been so worried about, oh, the collateral damage. It's war. We were attacked. We had every right to go in there. And that's just the way it is. And we kicked their asses pretty quickly and pretty thoroughly. We should have gone in much harsher, much bigger, and less concerned about winning over the hearts and minds of the Afghan people, and just killed all the terrorists we could find. And if you're having dinner with a terrorist, maybe you're just a nice guy farmer. If you're hanging out with terrorists and that's when the terrorist's number gets punched, then sorry, your dinner is going to be interrupted. We didn't. We sort of went in pussyfooting around, and then we stuck around. Now, we didn't stick around just to fight the war. We stuck around because we wanted to get into nation building. And there's this common misconception amongst the elites in this country of both parties that the rest of the world yearns to be like the United States. There are people around the world in every corner of it who do yearn to live in the United States because of our freedoms. There is no question about that. But that is a distinct minority in especially third world countries where education is not a priority. We assume that people yearn to be free. But I'll tell you this, the vast majority of people in countries that Americans would never even consider living in because they think of them as having oppressive regimes, and many of them do, the people there have no concept of freedom. It's not like 40 years ago they were free and then the Soviet Union came in and oppressed them for 50 years. And so they've been regaled with stories about what freedom used to be like, and they want to recapture it. These are people who have never understood liberal democracies. It hasn't existed where they lived. They live in tribes. They don't necessarily even consider themselves to be Afghani in Afghanistan. They consider themselves to be a member of whatever tribe. The same can be said for Iraq. They have no interest in living together and getting along and being tolerant. That's a Western value. These aren't Western countries. As soon as Iraq was free of Saddam Hussein, what happened? People celebrated in the streets for a couple of weeks and said, yay, great. And then they immediately went back to their centuries-old hatred of each other and got into their corners, got into their tribes, and started killing each other, trying to seize power for people like them. It wasn't, well, now we can set up a country where everybody's free and everybody's equal. No, they wanted to set up a government where they could use their tribe, they and their tribe could then go and punish the people in the other tribes who 250 years ago did something horrible, or 500 years ago did something horrible to their tribe. They don't yearn to be free because they don't have an understanding of what the concept of freedom is. So we stuck around. Well, in South and Central America, we worked with people who understood what the concept of freedom was to varying degrees. We didn't go down there and bomb them ourselves. We aided them, and we beat them. We beat the communists most of the time. But Beto is looking at that as a problem. Now, South and Central America, there are a lot of success stories down there. Not economic booms or certainly anything. It's going to be a long process, but it starts with freedom, and it starts with understanding the concept of a democracy and the concept of freedom. We don't have that in the Middle East. There is some of that down there. We need to get the hell out of Afghanistan, by the way. Just say, look, if you're going to allow the Taliban to come back into power, then you deserve to be oppressed. That's what you're voting for. And realistically, most of the Afghani people outside of the major, I can't even call them urban population, but the bigger cities like Kabul and what have you, are not even aware of the type of government they have. They farm for what they need. They, you know, eat what they grow. They eat what they raise. They take care of their family. They band together in tribal villages. And they're just not interested or even aware of what's going on in the rest of the world. We cannot impose our values there. In South and Central America, we didn't try to do it like that. We found some people who claimed to varying degrees. Again, I'm not saying that our Latin American policy has been gangbusters, but we found people who were at least interested in the vague concept of it, and they were willing to fight for it. And that's good. The Afghani people weren't really willing to fight for it. They had it imposed on them. The Iraqi people, some were, some weren't willing to fight for it. But for Beto to come out and say, well, all the wars that we started out there, it's horrible. We're monsters. We're awful people, and we never should have done it. No, the alternative was much, much worse. But that wasn't even the dumbest part of what Beto said. It's that you're driving your SUVs. That caused this massive drought in Guatemala. Where are you getting this from, Beto? Who's feeding you this crap? Who told you that a good electoral strategy after being, you know, a front runner and a media darling is now to call everything racist and blame everything on the United States. Now that I think about it, though, that might work in the Democratic primary. Maybe this new tactic will get... No, Beto is never going to be the nominee. It's just sad. Speaking of people who are never going to be the nominees, Mayor Bill de Blasio. He is probably the worst mayor in the history of New York, and that includes the people who were just engaged in open graft in the 19th century. And just, come on, bribe me. What do you got? Let's do it. The New York Times, this guy is so left-wing. The New York Times is a story. The headline is Desegregation Plan, Eliminate All Gifted Programs in New York. You're like, what the hell? The story, for years, New York has essentially maintained two parallel public school systems, a group for selective schools and programs geared towards students labeled as gifted and talented is filled mostly with white and Asian children. The rest of the system is open to all students and is predominantly black and Hispanic. Now, a high-level panel appointed by Mayor Bill de Blasio is recommending that the city do away with most of these selective programs in an effort to desegregate the system, which has 1.1 million students and is by far the largest in the country. So, New York City has some really... This is the way it was when I was in school. It wasn't in separate schools because there's only... There weren't that many schools. There weren't any space for them. It was one school district. But there were advanced classes. There were normal classes. And there were basic classes. The kids who were, you know, smarter than the other kids were in the advanced classes. Everybody else was in the normal classes. And then there was the basic classes that, well, you're a couple grades behind, but we don't want to hold you back. So we're just going to speak to you in a very condescending tone and take things a little slow. What was messed up was that your fate in at least my school district was determined in fifth grade. I still remember it. The MEAP test, the Michigan Education Assessment Placement Test or whatever. I bombed the hell out of it. I was terrible at it. Then it didn't really matter. It didn't affect your sixth grade because it was just one class. But when you got to junior high and the elementary schools combined into the one junior high, that's when you noticed that there was the smart kids, the normal kids, and the dumb kids. In seventh grade, I was in with the dumb kids because I did so horribly on the MEAP test that I was in basic everything. And I remember sitting there going, I know this stuff. Like, what the hell? I was just not very good at taking standardized tests, and I had not been yet diagnosed with dyslexia. By the end of, like, the second card marking, I was out of the basic classes and into the normal classes, and by ninth grade, I was in the advanced classes because they realized that maybe I wasn't completely stupid. I was in the advanced classes and everything by ninth grade except English, which I never got into the advanced classes for, which is kind of ironic considering what I do for a living now. But public schools, what are you going to do? But that was the dyslexia. But that's a good thing. Instead of, you know, slowing down the kids who need to be educated at a higher rate, at a higher level, at a higher rate of speed, instead of slowing them down, you put them in a different class, or in New York's case, since there are so many people, you put them in different schools so that they can achieve their full potential. The outrage here should not be that the majority in the gifted schools are white and Asians. And how'd the Asians get in there? If we're such a horribly racist country, why do Asians get a pass? Why do Asians, on average, have a higher income than whitey? Whitey's a racist. Whitey controls everything. White privilege is the flavor of the moment. How is it that Asians and Indians, by the way, managed to get through and beat Whitey at their own racism game? Maybe it's that Whitey isn't so racist. Maybe there are other factors. Maybe you should look into the out-of-wedlock birth rates. Maybe you should look into the divorce rates or the never-been-married rates with kids. Because the fastest way out of poverty is to not have kids until you're married and to actually get married. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Liberals aren't interested in that. But instead of going looking at that school and says that's gifted students, it's an outrage that there are so many whites and Asians there. Maybe look at the rest of the schools, especially the predominantly black schools and Hispanic schools in predominantly black and Hispanic neighborhoods, and say, how are you failing an elementary school? Why aren't you educating these kids? Because every kid can learn. Every kid has the same capacity to learn. Why aren't you churning out more people who are better at this? Why not kick them in the ass rather than say we need to get rid of the gifted program? We must erase, in order to desegregate the schools, we must punish the students who are doing better than everybody else. That's the liberals' answer to everything. When they look at somebody who's made a lot of money, it's not, look at that guy, kids. That person over there, they're a success. Look at what they've built. They took risks. They sacrificed. They worked hard. And it all paid off. No. Liberals point at them and say, look, kids, that person over there is a no-good pile of garbage SOB, and he must be taken down a notch or two because they don't deserve to have that much success. No. Instead of an example, which is what the people who are successful should be, they're now treated as a cautionary tale and a target of scorn. That has been that way in economics on the left for the last 40 years at least, and now it's dripping on down to education. They want to punish kids who can learn better, who are smarter, quite frankly, who got a better education than the ones who are trapped in the crappy schools that are majority black. Again, Democrat-controlled areas, Democrat-dominated areas. Baltimore, same thing. Detroit, same thing. The school system is a cesspool, is a massive failure. And there's never a Democrat who comes out and says, we got to figure out how to make these schools better. No, they look at the good schools and they say, well, we got to make those schools worse. We got to punish those damn kids because it's not fair that some kids are doing better than other kids. Yes, it is fair. It's fair to the, well, it's unfair to the kids who aren't doing well, but it's not because somebody else is doing better. It's because they're getting a really bad education from really bad educators, really bad administrators, led by really bad politicians. Maybe you guys should try and bring, it's not a, you know, they don't seem to ascribe to the idea that a rising tide lifts all boats. They ascribe to the idea that they need to sink all the boats so that everybody's on the bottom. It's messed up. It's anti-American. And it's going to have dire consequences. There's going to be a massive exodus from the New York public school system of all the gifted kids. Because parents who are involved in their kids' lives, who care about their kids' educations, aren't going to tolerate the government saying, well, yeah, your kid has great potential and could go really far. But you know what? That's making other students feel really bad about themselves. Or actually, the students probably aren't aware of it. It's making liberal politicians feel really bad. And so we're going to use your kid as a pawn and punish them. That's liberalism in a nutshell. These people can't do well because somebody else isn't doing as well. So rather than try and raise people up on the bottom, we're going to knock everybody down a notch. It's so stupid. That's Bill de Blasio. Thank God he'll never even sniff the presidency. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. You can email me, Derek@DailyCaller.com. If you want to enter to win the Ben Howe signed books, email me. Let me know about that. Any other compliments, complaints you got, I appreciate it. And I thank you again for the support, surprise support on GoFundMe for little Kivvy to get his testicles removed. Let's be honest. That's what they're going to do to him. The sooner the better. Maybe it'll calm him down a little. Otherwise, I will. I'll see you tomorrow. Have a great Tuesday.
I want to be clear. I'm not going nuts.